And now, said Vasiliev, after finishing his report, I bring to the notice of the meeting that I resign as chairman of the society and will not stand for re-election. He sat down. A little chill ran through the assembly. Beneath the burden of sorrow, Gorman closed his heavy lids. An electric train slid bow-like over a bass string. Next comes, said Professor Kraevich, raising his pince-nez to his eyes and looking at the agenda, the treasurer's report, if you please. Gorman's resilient neighbor, immediately adopting a challenging tone of voice, flashing his good eye and powerfully twisting his valuable crammed mouth, commenced to read. Figures were emitted like sparks. Metallic words bounced. Entered the current year. Debited. Audited. While Sheeran, in the meantime, swiftly began to note something on the reverse side of a cigarette pack, added it up, and triumphantly exchanged glances with Lishnevsky. Having read to the end, the treasurer shut his mouth with a click, while some distance off a member of the auditorial committee had already risen, a Georgian socialist with a pockmarked face and black hair like a shoebrush, and briefly enumerated his favorable impressions. After this, Sheeran asked for the floor, and at once there was a whiff of something jolly, alarming, and improper. He began by seizing on the fact that the expenditure for the New Year's charity dance was inexplicably large. Gorman wanted to reply. The chairman, aiming his pencil at Sheeran, asked him if he had finished. "Let him speak, no cutting short," shouted Shakhmatov from his seat, and the chairman's pencil, quivering like a serpent's tongue, was aimed at him before returning to Sheeran, who, however, bowed and sat down. Gorman rose heavily, carrying his sorrowful burden with disdain and resignation, and began to speak. But Sheeran soon interrupted him, and Kraevich grasped his bell. Gorman finished, after which the treasurer instantly asked for the floor, but Sheeran was already up and continuing. "The explanation of the honorable gentleman from the Stock Exchange." The chairman rang his bell and requested more moderation, threatening to refuse permission to speak. Sheeran again bowed and said that he had only one question. In the funds, according to the treasurer's words, there were 3,076 marks and 15 pfennigs. Could he see this money right now? "Bravo!" shouted Shakhmatov. And the least attractive member of the union, the mystical poet, guffawed, applauded, and almost fell off his chair. The treasurer, paling to a snowy shine, began to speak in a rapid patter. While he was speaking and being interrupted by impossible exclamations from the audience, a certain Shuf, lean, clean-shaven, looking somewhat like a Red Indian, left his corner, went up to the committee table unnoticed on his rubber soles, and suddenly slammed his red fist down on it so that even the bell gave a jump. "You're lying!" he bellowed, and returned to his seat. A row was breaking out on all sides, when to Sheeran's chagrin it transpired that there was yet another faction wishing to seize power, namely the group that was always left out, and that included both the mystic and the Red Indian, as well as the little bearded fellow, and several seedy and unbalanced individuals, one of whom suddenly began to read from a piece of paper a list of candidates for election to the committee, all of whom were completely unacceptable. The battle took a new turn, sufficiently tangled now that there were three warring sides. Such expressions flew about as, "Black marketeer, you're not fit to duel, and you've already been thrashed." Even Bush spoke, trying to drown insulting ejaculations, but because of the natural obscurity of his style, no one could understand what he was talking about, until sitting down, he explained that he was fully in agreement with the preceding speaker. Gorman, his nostrils alone expressing sarcasm, busied himself with his cigarette holder. Vasiliev left his seat and retired to a corner where he pretended to read a newspaper. Lishnevsky delivered a crushing speech directed mainly against the board member resembling a peaceful toad, who merely spread his hands and directed a helpless glance at Gorman and the treasurer, both of whom tried not to look at him. Finally, when the poet mystic stood up, shakily swaying, and with a highly promising smile on his sweaty, leathery face began to speak in verse, the chairman furiously rang his bell and announced an interval, after which the elections were due to be held. Shirin flew over to Vasilyev and commenced to talk to him persuasively, while Fyodor, feeling suddenly bored, found his Macintosh and made his way out onto the street. He was angry with himself. Fancy sacrificing for the sake of this preposterous divertissement the fixed star of his nightly meeting with Zina. The desire to see her at once tortured him with its paradoxical impossibility. If she had not slept 6 yards from the head of his bed, access to her would have been much easier. A train stretched over the viaduct. The yawn begun by a woman in the lighted window of the first car was completed by another woman in the last one. Fyodor Konstantinovich strolled toward the tram stop along an oily, black, blaring street. The illuminated sign of a music hall ran up the steps of vertically placed letters. They went out all together, and the light again scrambled up. What Babylonian word would reach up to the sky? A compound name for a trillion tints. Diamond, dim, luna, lilith, lila, sapphire, violent, violet, and so on. And how many more? Perhaps he should try to phone? He only had a dime in his pocket, and he had to decide. To phone meant that in any case he would not be able to take the tram. But to phone for nothing, that is, not to get Zina herself, to get her through her mother was not permitted by the code, and then to return on foot would be a bit too galling. I'll risk it. He went into a beer house, rang, and everything was over in a twinkle. He got the wrong number. That very number which the anonymous Russian was always trying to get, who always got the Shchogolevs. So what? He would have to hoof it, as Boris Ivanovich would say. At the next corner, his approach automatically triggered off the doll-like mechanism of the prostitutes who always patrolled there. One of them even tried to look like somebody lingering by a shop window, and it was sad to think that these pink corsets on their golden dummies were known to her by heart, by heart. "Sweetie," said another with a questioning smile. The night was warm with a dusting of stars. He walked at a swift pace, and his bared head felt light from the narcotic night air. And further on, when he walked along gardens, there came floating to him phantoms of lilacs, the darkness of foliage, and wonderful naked odors spreading on the lawns. He was hot, and his forehead was burning, when finally, quietly clicking the door shut behind him, he found himself in the dark hall. The opaque glass in the upper part of Zina's door resembled a radiant sea. She must be reading in bed, he thought. But while he stood and looked at this mysterious glass, she coughed, rustled, and the light went out. What an absurd torture! Go in there, go in! Who would know? People like her mother and stepfather sleep with insensible 100% sleep of peasants. Zina's punctiliousness. She would never open at the clinking tap of a fingernail. But she knows I'm standing in the dark hall and suffocating. This forbidden room during recent months had become a sickness, a burden, a part of himself, but inflated and sealed off. The pneumothorax of the night. He stood for another moment and on tiptoe stole into his room. All in all, French emotions. Femme amour. Sleep, sleep. The heaviness of spring is utterly untalented. Take oneself in hand. A monastic pun. What next? What exactly are we waiting for? In any case, I won't find a better wife. But do I need a wife at all? Put that liar away. I've no room to move. No, I would never hear that from her. That's the point. And a few days later, simply and even somewhat sillily, a solution was indicated to a problem which had seemed so complex that one could not help wondering if there was not a mistake in its construction. Boris Ivanovich, whose affairs during recent years had been getting worse and worse, was most unexpectedly offered by a Berlin firm quite a respectable representative's position in Copenhagen. In 2 months, by the 1st of July, he had to move there for at least a year, and perhaps forever, if all went well. Mariana Nikolaevna, who for some reason loved Berlin, familiar haunts, excellent sanitary arrangements, she herself, though, was filthy, felt sad at going away, but when she thought of the improvements in life awaiting her, her grief was dispersed. Thus, it was decided that from July, Zina would remain alone in Berlin, continuing to work for Traum, until Stjogolev had found her a job in Copenhagen, where Zina would go at the first summons. That is what the Stjogolevs thought. Zina had decided quite differently. It remained to regulate the question of the apartment. The Stjogolevs did not want to sell it, so they began to seek somebody to let it to. They found such a person. A young German with a great commercial future, accompanied by his fiancée, a plain, unmade-up, domestically sturdy girl in a green coat, inspected the apartment, dining room, bedroom, kitchen, Fyodor in bed, and was satisfied. However, he was taking the apartment only from August, so that for another month after the Stjogolevs' departure, Zina and the lodger would be able to stay there. They counted the days. 50, 49, 30, 25. Every one of these numbers had its own face. A beehive, a magpie in a tree, the silhouette of a knight, a young man. Their evening meetings had since spring gone beyond the shores of their initial street, lamp, lime, fence, and now their restless wanderings carried them in ever-widening circles into distant and ever-new corners of the city. Now it was a bridge over a canal, then a trellised bosquet in a park, behind which lights ran past, then an unpaved street between misty wastes where dark vans were standing, then some strange arcades, which were impossible to find during the daytime. Change of habits before migration. Excitement. A languorous pain in the shoulders. The newspapers diagnosed the still young summer as being exceptionally hot, and indeed there was a long dotted line of beautiful days, interrupted from time to time by the interjection of a thunderstorm. In the morning, while Zina was wilting from the stinking heat in the office, the sweaty armpits of Hammaker's jacket alone were more than enough. And what about the typist's necks melting like wax? What about the sticky blackness of carbon paper? Fyodor would go to spend the whole day in Grunewald, abandoning his lessons and trying not to think of the long-since-due payment for his room. Never before had he got up at 7. It would have seemed monstrous. But now, in life's new light, in which blended somehow the maturing of his gift, a premonition of new labors, and the approach of complete happiness with Zina, he experienced a direct pleasure from the speed and lightness of these early risings, from that burst of motion, from the ideal simplicity of three-second dressing, shirt, trousers, and sneakers on bare feet, after which he took a laprobe under his arm with the swim trunks wrapped in it, thrust on his way through the hall an orange and a sandwich into his pockets, and was already running down the stairs. A turned-back doormat held the door in a wide-open position, while the janitor energetically beat the dust out of another mat by slapping it against the trunk of an innocent lime tree. What have I done to deserve this? The asphalt was still in the dark blue shadow of the houses. On the sidewalk gleamed the first fresh excrements of a dog. A black hearse, which yesterday had been standing outside a repair shop, rolled cautiously out of a gate and turned down the empty street, and inside it, behind the glass and among artificial white roses, in place of a coffin, lay a bicycle. Whose? Why? The dairy was already open, but the lazy tobacconist was still asleep. The sun played on various objects along the right side of the street like a magpie picking out the tiny things that glittered. And at the end of it, where it was crossed by the wide ravine of a railroad, a cloud of locomotive steam suddenly appeared from the right of the bridge, disintegrated against its iron ribs, then immediately loomed white again on the other side, and wavily streamed away through the gaps in the trees. Crossing the bridge after this, Fyodor, as usual, was gladdened by the wonderful poetry of railroad banks, by their free and diversified nature. A growth of locusts and sallows, wild grass, bees, butterflies, All this lived in isolation and unconcern in the harsh vicinity of coal dust glistening below between the five streams of rails, and in blissful estrangement from the city coulisses above, from the peeled walls of old houses toasting their tattooed backs in the morning sunshine. Beyond the bridge, near the small public garden, two elderly postal workers, having completed their check of a stamp machine and grown suddenly playful, were stealing up from behind the jasmine, one behind the other, one imitating the other's gestures, toward a third, who, with eyes closed, was humbly and briefly relaxing on a bench before his working day, in order to tickle his nose with a flower. Where shall I put all these gifts with which the summer morning rewards me, and only me? Save them up for future books? Use them immediately for a practical handbook, How to Be Happy? Or, getting deeper to the bottom of things, understand what is concealed behind all this, behind the play, the sparkle, the thick green grease paint of the foliage. For there really is something. There is something. And one wants to offer thanks, but there is no one to thank. The list of donations already made, 10,000 days, from person unknown. He walked farther, past iron railings, past the deep gardens of bankers' villas with their grotto shadows, boxwood, ivy, and lawns pearled with watering. And there, among the elms and limes, the first pines already appeared, sent out far ahead by the Grunewald pine woods. Or, on the contrary, stragglers behind the regiment? Whistling loudly and rising uphill on the pedals of his three-wheeled bicycle, a baker's roundsman went by. A water sprayer crawled slowly by with a wet hissing sound, a whale on wheels generously irrigating the asphalt. Someone with a briefcase slammed a vermilion-painted garden gate and set off for some unknown office. Fyodor emerged on his heels onto the boulevard. Still the same Hohenzollern dam at whose beginning they burned poor Alexander Yakovlevich. And there, its lock flashing, the briefcase ran for a tram. Now it was not far to the forest, and he quickened his step, already feeling the sun's hot mask on his upturned face. The pickets of a fence flicked by, speckling his vision. On yesterday's vacant lot, a small villa was being built, and since the sky was looking in through the gaps of future windows, and since burdocks and sunlight had taken advantage of the slowness of the work to make themselves comfortable within the unfinished white walls, these had acquired the pensive cast of ruins, like the word sometime, which serves both the past and the future. Toward Fyodor came a young girl with a bottle of milk. She bore some resemblance to Zina, or rather contained a particle of that fascination, both special and vague, which he found in many girls, but with particular fullness in Zina, so that they all possessed some mysterious kinship with Zina about which he alone knew, although he was completely incapable of formulating the indicia of this kinship, outside of which women evoked painful disgust in him. And now, as he looked back at her and caught a long, familiar, golden, fugitive outline that promptly vanished forever, he felt for a moment the impact of a hopeless desire whose whole charm and richness was in its unquenchability. Oh, trite demon of cheap thrills, do not tempt me with the catchword, my type. Not that, but something beyond that. Definition is always finite, but I keep straining for the far away. I search beyond the barricades of words, of senses, of the world, for infinity, where all the lines meet. At the end of the boulevard, the green edge of the pine wood came into sight, with the gaudy portico of a recently constructed pavilion, in whose atrium was to be found an assortment of restrooms, men's, women's, and children's, through which, according to the scheme of the local Le Notres, one had to go in order to enter at first a newly laid-out rock garden with alpine flora along geometric paths, which served, still according to that same scheme, as a pleasant threshold to the forest. But Fyodor turned to the left, avoiding the threshold. It was nearer that way. The still wild edge of the pine wood stretched endlessly along an avenue for automobiles, but the next step on the part of the city fathers was inevitable. Fence the whole of this free access with endless railings, so that the portico became the entrance of necessity, in the most literal, elementary sense. I built this ornamental thing for you, but you weren't attracted, so now, if you please, it is ornamental and regimental. But by a mental jump back again, F3-GL, it could hardly have been better when this forest, now retreated, now crowded around the lake, and like us in our own departure from hairy ancestors, having kept only a marginal vegetation, used to stretch to the very heart of the present city, and a noisy, princely rabble galloped among its wilds with horns and hounds and beaters. The forest, as I found it, was still alive, rich, full of birds. There occurred orioles, pigeons, and jays. A crow flew by, its wings panting. A red-headed woodpecker was rapping against a pine trunk, and sometimes, I presume, imitating its own rap vocally, whereupon it came out particularly loud and convincingly for the female's benefit. For there is nothing in nature more bewitchingly divine than her ingenious deceptions cropping up in unexpected places. Thus, a forest grasshopper, starting his little motor but never able to get it going, tsig, 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 and breaks off, having jumped and landed, immediately readjusts the position of his body by turning in such a way as to make the direction of his dark stripes coincide with those of the fallen needles, or with their shadows. But careful, I like to recall what my father wrote. When closely, no matter how closely, observing events in nature, we must, in the very process of observation, beware of letting our reason, that garrulous dragoman who always runs ahead, prompt us with explanations which then begin imperceptibly to influence the very course of observation and distort it. Thus, the shadow of the instrument falls upon the truth. Give me your hand, dear reader, and let's go into the forest together. Look, first, at these glades with patches of thistle, nettle, or willow herb, among which you will find all kinds of junk, sometimes even a ragged mattress with rusty broken springs. Don't disdain it. Here is a dark thicket of small firs, where I once discovered a pit which had been carefully dug out before its death by the creature that lay therein, a young, slender-muzzled dog of wolf ancestry, folded into a wonderfully graceful curve, paws to paws. And now come bare hillocks, with no undergrowth, merely a carpet of brown needles beneath simplistic pines, which have a hammock stretched between them full of someone's unexacting body. And the wire skeleton of a discarded lampshade is also here, lying on the ground. Further, we have a barren, surrounded by locust trees. And there, on the grey, burning, sticky sand, sits a woman in underwear, her dreadful bare legs stretched out, and dons a stocking, while beside her crawls a child dark-groined from the dust. You can still see from here the thoroughfare and the sparkle of automobile radiators skimming by. But you only have to penetrate a little deeper, and the forest reasserts itself. The pines become nobler, moss creaks underfoot, and some bum is invariably asleep here, a newspaper covering his face. The philosopher prefers moss to roses. Here is the exact spot where a small airplane fell the other day. Someone who was taking his girl for a morning ride in the blue got over-exuberant, lost control of his joystick, and plunged with a screech and a crackle straight into the pines. I, unfortunately, came too late. They had had time to clear up the wreckage, and two mounted policemen were riding at a walk toward the road. But one could still see the imprint of a daring death beneath the pines, one of which had been shaved from top to bottom by a wing. And the architect Stockschmeisser, walking with his dog, was explaining to a nurse and child what had happened. But a few days later, all traces had disappeared. There was only the yellow wound on the pine tree. And already, in complete ignorance, an old man and his old woman, facing each other, she in her bodice and he in his underpants, were doing uncomplicated gymnastics on the same spot. Farther on, it became very nice. The pines had come into their own, and between their pinkish scaly trunks, the feathery foliage of low rowans and the vigorous greenery of oaks broke the stripiness of the pinewood sun into an animated dapple. In the density of an oak, when you looked from below, the overlapping of shaded and illumined leaves, dark green and bright emerald, seemed to be a jigsaw fitting together of their wavy edges. And on these leaves, now letting the sun caress its yellow-brown silk and now tightly closing its wings, there settled an angle-wing butterfly with a white bracket on its dark, mottled underside. Suddenly taking off, it alighted on my bare chest, attracted by human sweat. And still higher above my upturned face, the summits and trunks of the pines participated in a complex exchange of shadows, and their leafage reminded me of algae swaying in transparent water. And if I tilted my head back even farther, so that the grass behind, inexpressibly primevally green from this point of upturned vision, seemed to be growing downward into empty transparent light, I experienced something similar to what must strike a man who has flown to another planet, with a different gravity, different density, and a different stress on the senses. Especially when a family out for a stroll went by upside down, with every step they took becoming a strange elastic jerk, and a lobbed ball seemed to be falling ever more slowly into a dizzy abyss. If one advanced even further, not to the left where the pine wood stretched endlessly, and not to the right where it was interrupted by a coppice of young birches, freshly and childishly smelling of Russia, the forest again thinned out, lost its undergrowth, and straggled down sandy inclines, at the foot of which the broad lake rose in pillars of light. The sun changefully illuminated the opposite bank, and when with the onset of a cloud the very air seemed to close like a great blue eye and then slowly open again, one shore always lagged behind the other in the process of gradually fading and lighting up. There was practically no sandy border on the other side, and the trees descended altogether to the dense reeds, while higher up one could find hot, dry slopes overgrown with clover, sorrel, and spurge, and fringed with the rich, dark green of oaks and beeches that went trembling down to the damp hollows below, in one of which Yasha Chernyshevsky had shot himself. When in the mornings I entered this world of the forest, whose image I had raised, as it were, by my own efforts above the level of those artless Sunday impressions, paper trash, a crowd of picnickers, out of which the Berliner's conception of Grunewald was composed, when on these hot summer weekdays I walked over to its southern side, into its depths, to wild, secret spots, I felt as much delight as if this was a primeval paradise within 2 miles from Agamemnonstrasse. Coming to a favorite nook of mine, which magically combined a free flow of sunshine with protection by the shrubbery, I would strip to the skin and lie down supine on the rug, placing my unnecessary trunks beneath my head. Thanks to the suntan coating my entire body, so that only my heels, palms, and the ray-like lines around my eyes kept their natural tint, I felt myself an athlete, a Tarzan, an Adam, anything you like, only not a naked town dweller. The awkwardness with which nakedness is usually accompanied depends upon the awareness of our defenseless whiteness, which has long since lost all connection with the colors of the surrounding world, and for that reason finds itself in artificial disharmony with it. But the sun's impact restores the deficiency, makes us equal in our naked rights with nature, and the brazen body no longer experiences shame. All this sounds like a nudist brochure, but one's own truth is not to blame if it coincides with the truth some poor fellow has borrowed. The sun bore down. The sun licked me all over with its big, smooth tongue. I gradually felt that I was becoming moltenly transparent, that I was permeated with flame and existed only insofar as it did. As a book is translated into an exotic idiom, so was I translated into sun. The scrawny, chilly Chaimo Fyodor Godunov Cherdintsev was now as remote from me as if I had exiled him to the Yakutsk province. He was a pallid copy of me, whereas this estival one was his magnified bronze replica. My personal I, the one that wrote books, the one that loved words, colors, mental fireworks, Russia, chocolate, and Xena, had somehow disintegrated and dissolved. After being made transparent by the strength of the light, it was now assimilated to the shimmering of the summer forest, with its satiny pine needles and heavenly green leaves, with its ants running over the transfigured, most radiant-hued wool of the lap-robe, with its birds, smells, hot breath of nettles, and spermy odor of sun-warmed grass, with its blue sky, where droned a high-flying plane that seemed filmed over with blue dust, the blue essence of the firmament. The plane was bluish, as a fish is wet in water. One might dissolve completely that way. Fyodor raised himself and sat up. A streamlet of sweat flowed down his clean-shaven chest and fell into the reservoir of his navel. His flat belly had a brown and mother-of-pearl sheen to it. Over the glistening black ringlets of his pubic hair, a lost ant scrambled nervously. His shins shone glossily. Pine needles had got stuck between his toes. With his bathing trunks, he wiped his short-cropped head, sticky nape, and neck. A squirrel with an arched back loped across the turf from tree to tree in a wavy and almost clumsy course. The scrub oaks, elder shrubs, pine trunks, everything was dazzlingly spotted, and a small cloud, in no way defiling the face of the summer day, felt its way slowly past the sun. He got up, took a step, and immediately the weightless paw of a leafy shadow descended upon his left shoulder. It slipped off again at the next step. Fyodor consulted the position of the sun and dragged his rug a yard or so aside to prevent the shade of the leaves from encroaching upon him. To move around naked was astonishing bliss. The freedom around his loins especially pleased him. He walked between the bushes, listening to the vibration of insects and the rustling of the birds. A wren crept like a mouse through the foliage of a small oak. A sand wasp flew by low down, carrying a benumbed caterpillar. The squirrel he had just seen climbed up the bark of a tree with a spasmodic, scrabbly sound. Somewhere in the vicinity sounded girlish voices, and he stopped in a pattern of shadow, which stayed motionless along his arm, but palpitated rhythmically on his left side between the ribs. A golden, stumpy little butterfly, equipped with two black commas, alighted on an oak leaf, half opening its slanting wings, and suddenly shot away like a golden fly. And, as often happened on these woodland days, especially when he glimpsed familiar butterflies, Fyodor imagined his father's isolation in other forests, gigantic, infinitely distant, in comparison with which this one was but brushwood, a tree stump, rubbish. And yet he experienced something akin to that Asiatic freedom spreading wide on the maps, to the spirit of his father's peregrinations. And here it was most difficult of all to believe that despite the freedom, despite the greenery and the happy, sun-shot, dark shade, his father was nonetheless dead. The voices sounded closer and then receded. A horsefly that had settled unnoticed on his thigh managed to jab him with his blunt proboscis. Moss, turf, sand, each in its own way, communicated with the soles of his bare feet, and each in its own way, the sun and the shade, stroked the hot silk of his body. His senses, sharpened by the unrestricted heat, were tantalized by the possibility of sylvan encounters, mythical abductions. Le sanglot dont j'étais encore ivre. He would have given a year of his life, even a leap year, for Zena to be here. Or any of her corps de ballet. He again lay flat, then again got up. With a beating heart, he listened to sly, vague, vaguely promising noises. Then, pulling on only his trunks and hiding lap robe and clothes under a bush, he went off to wander through the woods around the lake. Here and there, thinly on weekdays, there occurred more or less orange bodies. He avoided looking closely for fear of switching from pan to punch. But sometimes, next to a school satchel, and beside her shiny bicycle propped against a tree trunk, a lone nymph would sprawl, her legs bared to the crotch, and swayed soft to the eye, and her elbows thrown back, with the hair of her armpits glistening in the sun. Temptation's arrow had hardly had time to sing out and pierce him before he noticed, a short distance away, at three equidistant points forming a magic triangle, around whose prize, and strangers to one another, three motionless hunters visible between the tree trunks, two young fellows, one lying prone, the other on his side, and an elderly man, coatless, with armbands on his shirt sleeves, sitting solidly on the grass, motionless and eternal, with sad but patient eyes. And it seemed that these three pairs of eyes, striking the same spot, would finally, with the help of the sun, burn a hole in the black bathing tights of that poor little German girl, who never raised her ointment-smeared lids. He descended to the sandy shore of the lake, and here in the roar of voices, the charmed fabric which he himself had so carefully spun completely fell to pieces. And he saw with revulsion the crumpled, twisted, deformed by life's nor'easter, more or less naked or more or less clothed, the latter were the more terrible, bodies of bathers, petty bourgeois, idle workers, stirring on the dirty gray sand. At the point where the shore road went along the lake's narrow lip, the latter was fenced off by stakes supporting tortured-looking remnants of sagging wire. And the place by these stakes was particularly valued by the beach habitués, partly because trousers could be conveniently hung by their suspenders on them, while underwear was laid on the dusty nettles, and partly because of the vague feeling of security from having a fence at one's back. Old men's gray legs, covered with growths and swollen veins, flat feet, the tawny crust of corns, pink porcine paunches, wet, shivering, pale, hoarse-voiced adolescents, the globes of breasts, voluminous posteriors, flabby thighs, bluish varices, goose flesh, the pimply shoulder blades of bandy-legged girls, the sturdy necks and buttocks of muscular hooligans, the hopeless, godless vacancy of satisfied faces. Romps, guffaws, roisterous splashing. All this formed the apotheosis of that renowned German good-naturedness which can turn so easily at any moment into frenzied hooting. And over all this, especially on Sundays when the crowding was vilest of all, there reigned an unforgettable smell, the smell of dust, of sweat, of aquatic slime, of unclean underwear, of aired and dried poverty, the smell of dried, smoked, potted soles a penny apiece. But the lake itself, with vivid green clumps of trees on the other side and a rippling wake of sunshine in the middle, bore itself with dignity. Having selected a private little creek among the bulrushes, Fyodor took to the water. Its warm opacity enveloped him. Sparks of sunshine danced before his eyes. He swam for a long time. Half an hour. 5 hours. 24. A week. Another. Finally, on the 28th of June, around 3 p.m., he came out on the other shore. Having made his way out of the lakeside spinach, he at once found himself in a grove, and from there he climbed onto a hot slope where he quickly dried in the sun. On the right was a ravine overgrown with oak brush and bramble. And today, just as every time that he came here, Fyodor descended into that hollow which always attracted him, as if he had been somehow guilty of the death of the unknown youth who had shot himself here, precisely here. He reflected that Alexandra Yakovlevna used to come here as well, rummaging purposefully among the bushes with her tiny black-gloved hands. He had not known her then, and could not have seen it, but from her account of her multiple pilgrimages, he felt it had been exactly like that, the search for something, the rustling of leaves, the prodding umbrella, the radiant eyes, the lips trembling with sobs. He recalled how he had met her this spring, for the last time, after her husband's death, and the strange sensation that overwhelmed him when looking at her lowered face with its unworldly frown, as if he had never really seen her before, and was now making out on her face the resemblance to her deceased husband, whose death was expressed on it through some hitherto concealed funereal blood relationship. A day later, she went away to some relatives in Riga, and already her face, the stories about her son, the literary evenings at her house, and Alexander Yakovlevich's mental illness, all this that had served its time, now rolled up of its own accord and came to an end, like a bundle of life tied up crosswise, which will long be kept, but which will never again be untied by our lazy, procrastinating, ungrateful hands. He was seized by a panicky desire not to allow it to close and get lost in a corner of his soul's lumber room, a desire to apply all this to himself, to his eternity, to his truth, so as to enable it to sprout up in a new way. There is a way, the only way. He ascended another slope, and there at the top, by a path which descended again, sitting on a bench beneath an oak tree, and slowly, pensively tracing the sand with his cane, was a round-shouldered young man in a black suit. How hot he must be, thought the naked Fyodor. The sitter looked up. The sun turned and slightly raised his face with a photographer's delicate gesture, a bloodless face with wide-set, myopically gray eyes. Between the corners of his starched collar, the type once called in Russia dog's delight, a stud gleamed above the slack knot of his tie. "How sunburned you are," said Koncheyev. "It can hardly be good for you." "And where, pray, are your clothes?" "Over there," said Fyodor, "on the other side, in the woods." "Someone might steal them," remarked Koncheyev. "It's not for nothing, there's a proverb. Free-handed Russian, light-fingered Prussian." The other sat down and said, "There is no such proverb. By the way, do you know where we two are? Beyond those blackberry bushes, down below, is the place where the Chernyshevsky boy, the poet, shot himself." "Oh, was it here?" said Koncheyev without a special interest. "You know, his Olga recently married a furrier and went off to the United States. Not quite the lancer whom Pushkin's Olga married, but still." "Aren't you hot?" asked Fyodor. "Not a bit. I have a weak chest and I always freeze. But of course when one sits next to a naked man, one is physically aware that there exist men's outfitters, and one's body feels blind. On the other hand, it seems to me that any mental work must be completely impossible for you in such a denuded state." "A good point," grinned Fyodor. "One seems to live more superficially, on the surface of one's own skin. That's it. All you're concerned with is patrolling your body and trailing the sun. But thought likes curtains, and the camera obscura. Sunlight is good in the degree that it heightens the value of shade. A jail with no jailer, and a garden with no gardener, that is, I think, the ideal arrangement. Tell me, did you read what I said about your book?
I did, replied Fyodor, watching a little geometried caterpillar that was checking the number of inches between the two writers.
I did indeed. At first I wanted to write you a letter of thanks. You know, with a touching reference to undeservingness and so on. But then I thought that this would have introduced an intolerable human smell into the domain of free opinion. And besides, if I produced a good book, I should thank myself and not you, just as you have to thank yourself and not me for understanding what was good. Isn't that true? If we start bowing to one another, then as soon as one of us stops, the other will feel hurt and depart in a huff.
I didn't expect truisms from you, said Kuncheyev with a smile.
Yes, all that is so. Once in my life, only once, I thanked a critic, and he replied, well, as a matter of fact, I really liked your book, and that really sobered me forever. By the way, I didn't say everything I could have said about you. You were so taken to task for non-existent defects that I no longer wanted to harp on those that were obvious to me. Furthermore, in your next work, you'll either get rid of them or they will develop into special virtues all your own, the way a speck on an embryo turns into an eye. You are a zoologist, aren't you?
In a way, as an amateur. But what are those defects? I wonder if they coincide with the ones I know.
First, an excessive trust in words. It sometimes happens that your words, in order to introduce the necessary thought, have to smuggle it in. The sentence may be excellent, but still it is smuggling, and moreover gratuitous smuggling, since the lawful road is open. But your smugglers, under the cover of an obscure style, with all sorts of complicated contrivances, import goods that are duty-free anyway. Secondly, there is a certain awkwardness in the reworking of the sources. You seem to be undecided whether to enforce your style upon past speeches and events, or to make their own more salient. I took the trouble to confront one or two passages in your book with the context in the complete edition of Chernyshevsky's works. Same copy you must have used. I found your cigarette ash between the pages. Thirdly, you sometimes bring up parody to such a degree of naturalness that it actually becomes a genuine, serious thought. But on this level, it suddenly falters, lapsing into a mannerism that is yours and not a parody of a mannerism, although it is precisely the kind of thing you are ridiculing. As if somebody parodying an actor's slovenly reading of Shakespeare had been carried away, had started to thunder in earnest, but had accidentally garbled a line. Fourthly, one observes in one or two of your transitions something mechanical, if not automatic, which suggests you are pursuing your own advantage and taking the course you find easier. In one passage, for example, a mere pun serves as such a transition. Fifthly, and finally, you sometimes say things chiefly calculated to prick your contemporaries. But any woman will tell you that nothing gets lost so easily as a hairpin, not to speak of the fact that the least swerve of fashion may make pins obsolete. Think how many sharp little objects have been dug up whose exact use not a single archaeologist can tell. The real writer should ignore all readers but one, that of the future, who in his turn is merely the author reflected in time. That, I think, is the sum of my complaints against you, and generally speaking, they are trivial. They're completely eclipsed by the brilliance of your achievements, about which I could still say a fair bit.
That is less interesting, said Fyodor,
who during this tirade, as Turgenev, Goncharov, Count Salyas, Grigorovich, and Boborikin used to write, had been nodding his head with an approving mien. You diagnosed my shortcomings very well, he continued, and they correspond to my own complaints against myself, although, of course, I put them in a different order. Some of the points run together, while others are subdivided further.
But besides the defects you have noted in my book, I am aware of at least three more. They perhaps are the most important of all. Only I'll never tell you them, and they won't be there in my next book. Do you want to talk about your poetry now?
No, thank you, I'd rather not, said Concheia fearfully. I have reasons for thinking that you like my work, but I'm organically averse to discussing it. When I was small, before sleep, I used to say a long and obscure prayer which my dead mother, a pious and very unhappy woman, had taught me. She, of course, would have said that these two things are incompatible, but even so, it's true that happiness doesn't take the veil. I remembered this prayer and kept saying it for years, almost until adolescence. But one day, I probed its sense, understood all the words, and as soon as I understood, I immediately forgot it, as if I'd broken an unrestorable spell. It seems to me that the same thing might happen to my poems, that if I try to rationalize them, I shall instantly lose my ability to write them. You, I know, corrupted your poetry long ago with words and meaning, and you will hardly continue writing verse now. You are too rich, too greedy. The muse's charm lies in her poverty. You know, it's odd, said Fyodor, that once, about 3 years ago, I imagined most vividly a conversation with you on these subjects, and you know it came out somewhat similar, although, of course, you shamelessly played up to me and all that. The fact that I know you so well, without knowing you, makes me unbelievably happy, for that means there are unions in the world which don't depend at all on massive friendships, asinine affinities, or the spirit of the age, nor on any mystical organizations or associations of poets where a dozen tightly knit mediocrities glow by their common efforts. At all events, I want to warn you, said Concheia frankly, not to flatter yourself as regards our similarity. You and I differ in many things. I have different tastes, different habits. Your Fiet, for instance, I can't stand. And on the other hand, I am an ardent admirer of the author of The Double and The Possessed, whom you are disposed to slight. There is much about you I don't like. Your St. Petersburg style, your Gallic taint, your neo-Voltairianism, and weakness for Flaubert. And I find, forgive me, your obscene, sporty nudity simply offensive. But then, with these reservations, it would be true, probably, to say that somewhere, not here, but on another plane, of whose angle, by the way, you have an even vaguer idea than I, somewhere on the outskirts of our existence, very far, very mysteriously and inexpressibly, a rather divine bond is growing between us. But perhaps you feel and say all this because I praised your book in print. That also happens, you know. Yes, I know. I thought of that myself. Especially since formerly I used to envy your fame. But in all conscience... Fame, interrupted Koncheyev. Don't make me laugh. Who knows my poems? 1,000, 1,500, at the very outside, 2,000 intelligent expatriates, of whom, again, 90% don't understand them. 2,000 out of 3 million refugees. That's provincial success, but not fame. In the future, perhaps I shall recoup. But a great deal of time will have to elapse before the Tungus and the Kalmuk of Pushkin's Exegi Monumentum begin to tear out of each other's hands my communication, with the Finn looking enviously on. But there is a comfortable feeling, said Fyodor meditatively. One can borrow on the strength of the legacy. Doesn't it amuse you to imagine that one day, on this very spot, on this lakeside, beneath this oak tree, a visiting dreamer will come and sit and imagine in his turn that you and I once sat here? And the historian will dryly tell him that we never took a walk together, that we were hardly acquainted, and that if we did meet, we only talked about routine trifles. But nevertheless, try. Try to experience that strange future retrospective thrill. All the little hairs on the soul stand on end.
It would be a good thing in general to put an end to our barbaric perception of time. I find it particularly charming when people talk about the earth freezing in a trillion years and everything disappearing unless our printing shops are moved in good time to a neighboring star. Or the drivel about eternity. So much time has been allotted to the universe that the date of its end should already have come. Just as it is impossible in a single segment of time to imagine whole an egg lying on a road along which an army is endlessly marching. How stupid. Our mistaken feeling of time as a kind of growth is a consequence of our finiteness, which, being always on the level of the present, implies its constant rise between the watery abyss of the past and the aerial abyss of the future. Existence is thus an eternal transformation of the future into the past, an essentially phantom process, a mere reflection of the material metamorphoses taking place within us. In these circumstances, the attempt to comprehend the world is reduced to an attempt to comprehend that which we ourselves have deliberately made incomprehensible. The absurdity at which searching thought arrives is only a natural generic sign of its belonging to man, and striving to obtain an answer is the same as demanding of chicken broth that it begin to cluck. The theory I find most tempting, that there is no time, that everything is the present, situated like a radiance outside our blindness, is just as hopeless a finite hypothesis as all the others. You will understand when you are big. Those are really the wisest words that I know. And if one adds to this that nature was seeing double when she created us, oh, this accursed pairing which is impossible to escape, horse, cow, cat, dog, rat, mouse, flea, bug, that symmetry in the structure of live bodies is a consequence of the rotation of worlds. A top that spins for sufficiently long will begin perhaps to live, grow, and multiply. And that in our straining toward asymmetry, toward inequality, I can detect a howl for genuine freedom, an urge to break out of the circle.
Herrliches Wetter! In der Zeitung steht es aber, dass es morgen bestimmt regnen wird, said finally the young German who was sitting beside Fyodor on the bench, and who had seemed to him to resemble Koncheyev.
Imagination again. But what a pity! I'd even thought up a dead mother for him in order to trap truth. Why can a conversation with him never blossom out into reality, break through to realization? Or is this a realization, and nothing better is needed? Since a real conversation would be only disillusioning, with the stumps of stuttering, the chaff of hemming and hawing, the debris of small words.
Da kommen die Wolken schon, continued the Koncheyevoid German, pointing his finger at a full-breasted cloud rising in the west.
A student, most probably, perhaps with a philosophical or musical vein. Where is Yasha's friend now? He would hardly be likely to come here.
Halb fünf ungefähr, he added, in response to Fyodor's question, and gathering his cane, he left the bench. His dark, stooping figure receded along the shady footpath. Perhaps a poet? After all, there must be poets in Germany. Puny ones, local ones, but all the same, not butchers. Or only a garnish for the meat.
He was too lazy to swim back to the other side. He followed leisurely the trail that skirted the lake along its northern edge. At the spot where a wide, sandy declivity reached the water, with the uncovered roots of apprehensive pines supporting the sliding bank, there were some more people, and down below, on a strip of grass, lay three naked corpses, white, pink, and brown, like a triple sample of the sun's action. Further on, along the bend of the lake, there was a marshy stretch, and the dark, almost black soil of the path stuck refreshingly to his bare heels. He went upwards again over a needle-scattered slope and walked through the speckled forest toward his lair. All was cheerful, sad, sunny, shady. He did not feel like returning home, but it was time. For a moment, he lay down by an old tree that had seemed to have beckoned to him. "Show you something interesting." A little song sounded among the trees, and presently there came into view, walking at a brisk pace, 5 nuns, round-faced, wearing black dresses and white coifs, and the little song, half schoolgirlish, half angelic, hovered about them the whole time, while first one and then another bent down on the move to pluck a modest flower, invisible to Fyodor, although he was lying close by, and then straightened up very nimbly, simultaneously drawing level with the others, taking up the rhythm, and adding this ghost flower to a ghostly nosegay with an idyllic gesture, the thumb and index touching for an instant, the other fingers delicately curved. And it all looked so much like a staged scene. And how much skill there was in everything. What an infinity of grace and art. What a director lurked behind the pines. How well everything was calculated. They're walking slightly out of order and then leveling out again, 3 in front and 2 behind. And the fact that one of the girls behind giggled briefly, a very cloistral sense of humor, because suddenly one of those in front had, with a touch of expansiveness, almost splashed her hands over a particularly heavenly note, and the way the song dwindled as it receded, while a shoulder continued to stoop and fingers sought a stalk of grass, but the latter, merely swaying, remained to gleam in the sun. Where had this happened before? What had straightened up and started to sway? And now they all departed through the trees on quick feet in buttoned shoes, and some half-naked little boy, pretending to seek a ball in the grass, rudely and automatically repeated a snatch of their song, in what musicians call a clowning refrain. How it had been mounted! How much labor had gone into this light, swift scene, into this deft traverse! What muscles there were beneath that heavy-looking black cloth, which would be exchanged, after the intermission, for gossamer ballet skirts. A cloud blocked the sun. The light in the forest drifted and gradually faded. Fyodor walked to the clearing where he had left his clothes. In the hole beneath a bush which always sheltered them so obligingly, he now found only a single sneaker. His rug, his shirt, and his trousers had vanished. There is a story to the effect that a passenger who inadvertently dropped his glove out of a train window promptly threw out its mate so that at least the person who found them should have a pair. In this case, the thief had acted the other way. The old, badly worn sneakers were probably no good to him, but in order to make fun of his victim, he had separated the pair. Furthermore, a scrap of newspaper had been left in the sneaker with a penciled inscription. Vielen Dank. Fyodor wandered all around, finding no one and nothing. The shirt was frayed, and he did not mind losing it, but he was somewhat grieved about the plaid lap robe brought all the way from Russia, and the good flannel pants quite recently bought. Together with the trousers had gone 20 marks, obtained 2 days before for at least partial payment of his room. Also gone were a small pencil, a handkerchief, and a bunch of keys. The latter, somehow, was worst of all. If nobody happened to be at home, which might easily be the case, it would be impossible to get into the apartment. The edge of a cloud dazzlingly caught fire, and the sun slipped out. It emitted such hot, blissful strength that, forgetting his vexation, Fyodor lay down on the moss and began to watch the next snowy colossus draw near, eating up the blue as it advanced. The sun slid into it smoothly, its rim of funeral fire quivering and splitting as it glided through the white cumulus. And then, finding a way out, it first threw out 3 rays and then expanded, filling the eyes with spotted fire, blackballing them, so that no matter where you looked, domino patterns glided past. And as the light got stronger or died away, all the shadows in the forest breathed and did push-ups. A small incidental relief was supplied by the fact that, thanks to the Shchogolevs going away the following day to Denmark, there would be an extra set of keys. which meant he could keep quiet about the loss of his bunch.
Going away, going away, going away. He imagined what he had constantly been imagining during the past 2 months. Beginning tomorrow night of his full life with Zena. The release, the slaking. And meanwhile, a sun-charged cloud filling up, growing, with swollen turquoise veins, with a fiery itch in its thunder root, rose in all its turgid, unwieldy magnificence and embraced him, the sky, and the forest. And to resolve this tension seemed a monstrous joy incapable of being borne by man. A ripple of wind ran over his chest. Its excitement slowly subsided. The air grew dark and sultry. It was necessary to hurry home. Once more he searched under the bushes, then shrugged his shoulders, pulled the elastic belt of his trunks tighter, and set out on his way back. When he left the forest and started to cross a street, the tarry stickiness of the asphalt under his bare foot proved to be a pleasant novelty. It was also interesting to walk on the sidewalk. Dream lightness. An elderly passerby in a black felt hat stopped, looked back after him, and made a coarse remark. But immediately, by way of happy compensation, a blind man sitting with a concertina against a stone wall mumbled his small request for alms and squeezed out a polygon of music as if there were nothing out of the way. It was odd, though. Surely he must have heard that I was barefoot. 2 schoolboys shouted at the naked passerby as they rode past, clinging to the back of a tram, and then the sparrows returned to the turf between the rails whence they had been frightened by the clattering yellow car. Drops of rain had begun to fall, and it was as if someone were applying a silver coin to different parts of his body. A young policeman detached himself from a newspaper stand and came over to him. "It's forbidden to walk about the city like that," he said, looking Fyodor in the navel. "Everything's been stolen," explained Fyodor briefly. "That mustn't happen," said the policeman. "Yes, but it happened all the same," said Fyodor, nodding. Several people had already stopped by them and were following the dialogue with curiosity. "Whether you've been robbed or not, you can't go about the streets naked," said the policeman, growing angry. "Quite, but I have to get somehow to the taxi stand. See, you can't in that state. Unfortunately, I'm unable to turn into smoke or grow a suit. And I'm telling you, you can't walk about like that," said the policeman. "Unheard of shamelessness," commented someone's thick voice from the back. "In that case," said Fyodor, "it remains for you to fetch me a taxi while I stand here. Standing in the nude is also impossible," said the policeman. "I'll take off my trunks and imitate a statue," suggested Fyodor. The policeman took out his notebook and so fiercely tore the pencil out of the pencil hold that he dropped it on the sidewalk. Some workman or other servilely picked it up. "Name and address," said the policeman, boiling. "Count Fyodor Godunov Cherdintsev," said Fyodor. "Stop being funny and tell me your name," roared the policeman. Another one came up with a higher rank and inquired what the matter was. "My clothes were stolen in the forest," said Fyodor patiently, and suddenly felt that he was completely wet from the rain. One or two standers by had run beneath the shelter of an awning, and an old woman standing by his elbow put up her umbrella, nearly gouging his eye out. "Who stole them?" asked the sergeant. "I don't know, and what's more, I don't care," said Fyodor. "Right now I want to go home, and you're detaining me." The rain suddenly grew heavier and swept across the asphalt. The whole of its surface seemed to be covered with jumping little candles. The policeman, all matted and blackened by the damp, probably considered the cloudburst to be an element in which bathing trunks were, if not appropriate, then at least permissible. The younger one again tried to obtain Fyodor's address, but his senior waved his hand, and the two of them, slightly quickening their sedate pace, retreated under the awning of a grocer's shop. The glistening Fyodor Konstantinovich ran through the noisy splashing of the rain, turned the corner, and shot into an automobile. Arriving home and telling the driver to wait, he pressed the button, which until 8 p.m. automatically opened the front door, and hurled himself up the stairs. He was let in by Mariana Nikolaevna. The hall was full of people and things.
Shchogolev in his shirt sleeves, two fellows struggling with a box, in which it seems was the radio, a comely milliner with a hat box, a coil of wire, a pile of linen from the laundry. "You're crazy," cried Mariana Nikolaevna. "For God's sake, pay the taxi," said Fyodor, wriggling his cold body through the people and things, and finally, over a barricade of trunks, he crashed his way through to his room. They had supper all together that evening, and later on were to come the Kasatkins, the Baltic Baron, another person or two. At table, Fyodor gave an embellished account of his misadventure, and Shchogolev laughed heartily, while Mariana Nikolaevna wanted to know, not without reason, how much cash there had been in the pants. Zina only shrugged her shoulders, and with unusual frankness urged Fyodor to help himself to the vodka, obviously fearing that he had caught a chill. "Well, our last evening," said Boris Ivanovich, having laughed to his heart's content. "May you prosper, signor. Someone told me the other day that you dashed off a pretty nasty paper on Petrashevsky. Very laudable. Listen, Mama, there's another bottle there. No point in taking it with us. Give it to the Kasatkins." "So you're going to remain an orphan," he continued, starting on the Italian salad and devouring it with the utmost sloppiness. "I don't think our Zinaida Askarovna will look after you too well. Eh, Princess?" "Yes, that's how it is, my dear chap. One twist of fate, and the king is mate. I never thought that fortune would smile on me. Touch wood, touch wood. Why, only last winter, I was wondering what to do. Tighten my belt, or sell Mariana Nikolaevna for scrap. You and I had a year and a half of cohabitation, if you'll excuse the expression, and tomorrow we part, probably forever. Man is fate's plaything. Happy today, pappy tomorrow." When supper was over, and Zina had gone down to let the guests in, Fyodor retreated noiselessly to his room, where everything was animated by rain and wind.